Hey there, AYT listeners. Just want to jump in quick before the show starts proper. Give a shout out to our sponsor on this episode, and it comes from our friends at the Criterion Collection. Specifically, I like to usually shout out a release or two on Blu-ray from Criterion. This week is no different, as they have put out the Jim Jarmusch classic, I would say, from 1995, Dead Man, the film starring Johnny Depp, sort of an bizarre acid western, I guess, if you wanted to call it that. But it's certainly a unique film and one of my favorites from unique filmmaker in Jarmusch. Find that disc anywhere you buy Blu-rays or DVDs these days. And don't forget that Criterion has a curated selection of their collection of films also available on Filmstruck if streaming is your jam. So we thank the Criterion Collection for doing awesome work and especially for supporting this podcast. Now on with the show.
In 5, 4, 3, 2.
The Larry Sanders Show. Tonight, join Larry and his guest and me, hey now, Hank Kingsley. And now, because we've tried it with just the desk and it really isn't the same, Larry Sanders.
Hello and welcome to Adjust Your Tracking. I'm Eric McClanahan.
I'm Joe Von Oppen.
Hey, buddy. We often on this show, I feel like it's not even an exaggeration to say, we tend to sort of look at movies, the more common movies, the movies in the fictional realm, the made-up stories. We all really tend to like that.
Yeah.
They get the most attention, but we're gonna go into that nonfiction realm for this episode, right?
Yeah, we're gonna keep it real today.
Oh, nice.
With a series of documentaries. The first of which is by William Friedkin, who, like, his first film was a documentary. It got him, like, noticed. It was The People versus Paul Crump. Was that the right title?
I'm going to trust you on that. I'll look it up. Keep talking.
And it was, like, you know, heralded as, like, you know, it ended up, like, exonerating this man, got him off death row in the same way that The Thin Blue Line did later for Errol Morris. And it really put William Friedkin on the map. And, you know, this was a time where I think documentary wasn't, you know, nearly as omnipresent. And, you know, like, it, he used it as a segue into feature filmmaking. And he took that sort of, like, gritty, realistic approach. And sort of, like, that was his touch that he brought to, like, his early 70s movies, like The French Connection. And then later The Exorcist, that's, like, less realistic, but had, like, a immediacy that felt real and horrifying and overwhelming. And so his new documentary is about a real life actual exorcist. It's called The Devil and Father Amorth. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's Amorth. The H is silent. I thought that's how he pronounced it, but yes.
Okay. So yeah, it's a pretty brisk documentary. It's an hour and 8 minutes, pretty slight, you know, in the scheme of things, especially with the other documentary series we're going to be discussing later in the episode.
Right.
A 6+ exhaustive and thoroughly rewarding. Anyway, so let's just stay on task with this one.
It's going to be hard to, though.
It was interesting. And this is going to come out, I think, theatrically and VOD.
Well, it's out in New York and LA, I think, just this past week. And it played in like 3 screens. It possibly LA, but definitely New York.
Okay. So while watching it, I don't know that it, like, especially in the sort of like glut of other documentary titles that seem to be going just straight to streaming now. This one doesn't necessarily demand the theatrical treatment. And like you and I have always said that, you know, regardless of what the film is, like, everything benefits from being seen in the dark on a big screen with like decent immersive sound. And watching this, I was just like, yeah, I don't know, this seems right at home on my laptop. So I'm not, because there's just something slight removed and slightly out of touch with like the approach that he has. It feels more at home with like a Lifetime special of paranormal events than it does an actual cinematic documentary feature.
This is true.
You know,
it's true.
like the narration by him is featuring him like in a lot of sort of talking head moments for him. Like, you know, he's burdened with like a lot of the narration and it's like, here is the house. And it just recalled Robert Stack and Unsolved Mysteries, a show that I love, but I love it as I'm watching it as a television show and not trying to lose myself in as a sort of documentary feature. And yeah, it was like, I don't know, like I would have watched a paranormal type Lifetime series special by William Friedkin, or at least I would have put it in my queue to then never watch it, which is almost the same thing nowadays. But like to approach it as like a feature film, you know, a feature documentary, is just like it starts to crumble underneath the weight of what that means. Mm-hmm. You know,
we're in a weird time right now. I do know. I know. Yeah. We're in a weird time where it's like, I know I've talked about this before. I think we have collectively of like, to me, this all gets down to like, know the medium that you like. It's all about choosing the right medium for whatever story you have to tell. And because TV and streaming especially has made that so expansive that the lines are blurred as to what makes a film and what's a TV show and who really cares, you know, the People versus OJ Simpson or no. What was the OJ Simpson documentary? Made in America, right?
Yeah.
That example that created a controversy where now Oscar won't let TV, like they disqualified something like that, which won the Oscar that year, like after the fact. So there's all this controversy about like, you know, what makes a film now because of these different avenues to show them. So I think the onus is on a filmmaker more and more. And maybe the fault in this regard for The Devil and Father Amort is in the distributor, because there's a sensationalism to this story and footage that you could see that no one has really been able to see before. That's kind of like a great hook. And I think that's the one reason that The Orchard, which is a really cool indie distributor, probably thought, well, let's try to put this out in some theaters. It's William Friedkin. We can angle it with The Exorcist. And they saw an opportunity to maybe make a little extra money from that. I guess I don't fault them for that, but this is a fucking TV episode at best, you know? Really what it is, I'd say beyond that, is this is a special feature on, and this should be included on the next Exorcist Blu-ray release, you know, as to me, it only even comes close to approaching like working is about as nice as I can be to it, is it would only work as a complimentary,
a supplemental thing
to The Exorcist, because part of what's kind of wrong with it is that it's supposed to sort of be a tribute to this guy, Father Amort, who he's since passed, but it's like supposed to be a tribute to this guy who is one of the Vatican's like leading exorcists that actually does these on a regular basis or did. And William Friedkin can't help but make it about him and his legacy with The Exorcist. And hey, I love William Friedkin as a raconteur. I think you've seen him somewhat recently in the last few years speaking, maybe with Nicholas Winding Refn. I want to know, you could tell me that, but like, he's a great raconteur. I like him as a personality. He's a hilarious blowhard, but he's engaging to listen to. But, this movie, you know, kind of isn't the best use of that, I guess.
Yeah, in fact, I would rather this be a 68-minute just conversation about him making The Exorcist as opposed to trying to like thread together like what is interesting footage and interesting material and like really provocative, but somehow in the context of what feels like a sort of hokey TV show becomes like, it starts to feel fake even though it's insisting on its reality.
Yeah.
So it's just like he is interesting enough, his experiences are interesting enough, his approach to filmmaking is fascinating. So it's just like, I did listen to him at the Cine Family, rest in peace, after they premiered the 4K restoration of Sorcerer.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah, he talked at great length to the point where I was just like, I'm filled up. I've heard enough. I've heard enough of his stories. Gotta go. And an hour after a like pretty lengthy movie, or at least like if it's not over long, it's an exhausting movie. And
you get put to the ringer. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he's like, I'm ready for more. Let's talk 2 hours. Oh my God. So Yeah, I don't know. It's just interesting to have somebody who had his, like, you know, like he knows how to find the pulse of like a provocative story, and he knows how to get to just like cut to like the absolute visceral like core of something, and like to not be able to access the in the documentary form at this point was just like, it was kind of frustrating, especially when there's, you know, like as we're approaching this episode, like there's plenty of other solid documentaries to get lost in. Maybe we should transition to them.
Maybe we should. Real quick, I want to finish on this with just saying that there is a Vanity Fair article that William Friedkin first wrote about this experience of him. It's actually like as he was making the film or after, I think he wrote this article for them. It's from 2016, and it's very easy to find. Just type William Friedkin, The Devil, and like William Friedkin, Vanity Fair. You'll find it. And he wrote it, and it is essentially this documentary written out. And I found, after the fact, I found the article to be the much better, also a better medium for this story, because there are leaps that you have to take, leaps of faith, one might say, to kind of go with Friedkin on this documentary or this story. And reading it is just much, it's easier. Whereas you're seeing things in this movie that part of one thing I really liked about this documentary is William Friedkin is an open-minded guy. I'm very impressed by that. He's open to sort of different ideas and things that are easily, I would say, dismissible. But having said that, I watched this movie and I couldn't help but several scenes feel like I just kept wanting to call bullshit on it. That like, how am I supposed to just believe that this is what I'm seeing? So having said that, this article in Vanity Fair, that's how I would approach this story. That if people are curious about what happened, that's where I would recommend. And then the other thing, it references what you said. There's a great two-part podcast that just got released by a friend podcast of ours called The Talk House. And it's Guillermo del Toro and William Friedkin talking for like an hour plus. And it's such a great chat, and it really brings out the best of Friedkin's sort of blowhardiness is tempered by Del Toro's equal enthusiasm and cinephilia. Like, these two really like each other, you can tell very early. And that's where you want to get your William Friedkin fix, I would say. So that podcast is special as well. And the last thing I want to just reference before we do turn to our more substantial chat on other movies is there is a really good recently released made as a supplemental special feature for a Blu-ray release making of documentary on the new Star Wars The Last Jedi Blu-ray. It's called The Director and the Jedi, and it is a proper 90 plus minute making of behind the scenes on the making of that film. And I'll tell you, I really liked The Last Jedi, but I would say people that, even if there are plenty of people that did not like that movie, that documentary might be worth watching. And I just thought, as a supplemental thing, it knew what it wanted to be. It knew where it belonged. It's premiered at some festivals, this documentary, but essentially it's just going to live as an additional element to a big Disney movie, right? But that's where it belongs, and it shines as that. It has no illusions as to what it is, and it tells its story really well. And that's a great example of something like that, that at least knew what it was. So I kind of wish we had a little more of that foresight with The Devil and Father Amort, but you know, can't argue with these distributors trying to maybe make an extra buck.
Everybody felt they were there at the beginning of the great experiment, like we were the chosen people.
I'm here in one of the largest ranches in the Northwest. Today, it's Rajneesh Puram, because a prominent Indian guru and his followers bought it.
Our vision was to create a community
based on compassion and sharing.
Bhagwan's agenda was simply to raise the consciousness of humanity. That was his goal.
America was land of promise. It was my conviction we will have no problems.
I don't think America has a place for these people.
Everyone in Antelope mistrusts Rajneesh.
I want that guru and his evil influence out of my city.
Both documentary series we're going to be talking about today have been out for kind of a while. But I think the conversation, you know, was most rabid about Wild Wild Country, which came out on Netflix a few weeks ago. And I was able to catch up with you, watched it immediately. Mm-hmm. But I was able to catch up with last week, and just the sense of like immersion in like this series, which like not unlike O.J. Simpson Made in America, had this like quality of like just having this huge sprawling saga of a story that you could just get lost in. And like once, you know, something has the freedom of being like that many hours and can go down that many avenues of the story, like there's just like it's unparalleled. And it's like, I know that O.J. Simpson Made in America did play theatrically a few times, I think enough to qualify it for the Oscar nomination, but just like imagine sitting through like uninterrupted, like just an unbroken experience of watching 7 hours of this. And it's that riveting. Like it would keep you that enthralled. I think it would chew you up and spit you out the other end, like pretty, you know, used up. But like Wild Wild Country is that, like that thorough, that immense, immersive, and exhausting. And it's just, it follows a cult called the Rajna cult. That's mean to say at first, because they were, it was a religion, it was a mindset, a lot of, you know, like similar movements were kind of coming out of the like the post hippies like era of people trying to find like alternative ways of living. And like this one was based in India and became known as the Rajneeshis, who relocated to a sort of remote area of Oregon to build their commune and their utopia. And it quickly took on a sort of like life of its own that after its sort of utopian goals tipped into a dystopia, a sort of like poisoning happened, literal and figurative. And it was just like, you know, like I'd heard like people just getting really like lost in like in the series that came out on Netflix a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't cautious about it, like I was interested, but I was like, I don't know, I don't have time for this. But like once you make time, like all the time clips past really incredibly quickly, because mm-hmm. like it's so easy to get lost in it, to the point where like 4 episodes in out of the 6 episodes, I texted you and I was like, I think I'm gonna really miss these people once the experience is over. And like these are incredibly flawed, like at times insane seeming people that are all speaking frankly and for themselves in interview segments that, you know, recall a lot of Errol Morris's best work. But like this is a pretty fascinating documentary in terms of like what it pulls from and where it takes you to.
I agree, man. You know, the memory that is most strong right now for me with watching this, because we watched it that first weekend it dropped on Netflix, me and my girlfriend, and it was like, even though I work on the weekends, we got through it, I think, after that. It was one of those truly binge experiences that I, like you, try to, if nothing else, I always try to be sort of hesitant or suspicious of that, because I just don't want to get sucked down and lose days like that anymore. You know, it just, yeah. I see the fun in it, and it really was fun with Wild Country, but because I'm more cautious and I try to just be like, all right, I'll parse this stuff out. You know, there's always time to watch this. But when you do get hooked on something like this, it makes the case for how exciting Netflix, which has this Netflix, you can find it there, streaming, is what makes these new streaming avenues like very exciting for the potential, because it's the perfect, it goes back to what I started with the Friedkin documentary. This was chosen for its perfect thing. It's a mini series. It needs that length. It needs chapters, different episodes. Yeah. And it's so perfectly constructed and was made in the right medium. So I love that right off the bat. But yeah, so I get sucked into it. Loved the binge effect of it. I do miss these people you're talking about. It's one of these great series where the length allows you to feel like you get to know these people almost intimately that are being interviewed. And I love that experience. Of course, we all want to like the characters we're watching in a movie. But Yeah, I'm just very excited. Like, this is like a great experience, great documentary effort. But like, I'm also just get excited for like, God, that means more of these can come here and we can get more stuff like this, because this is a documentary that is rewarding on many levels, but kind of awesome because of all the archival footage that was used.
Yeah.
Like, that changes this movie. And again, similar, I think it is kind of for me and maybe for you as well. This year, it feels like this year's OJ Made in America. It does feel like that OJ documentary where there was just all this footage of these people in Wild Wild Country, because the Rahanishis like filmed everything or shot everything on videotape. They were very media savvy, and there's all this footage. So the movie is not just talking heads. It's able to go back and forth in time, literally, with this footage. And that makes it super special and fascinating. And the footage they have is incredible. And then it just makes it this impressive Herculean task that I think the directors, they're the Way brothers. They made a great little documentary also on Netflix called The Battered Bastards of Baseball, which is about a Portland minor league baseball team from the 70s, Portland, Oregon. And Kurt Russell's dad owned them. And super fascinating movie. I think we talked about it years ago. These guys are really impressive directors. And I love this sort of Oregon Pacific Northwest focus they have so far in these few efforts they've made. But they really like get this area. They really are, I think, really good interviewers, because the stuff they get out of people on all sides is very revealing and fascinating. And what can I say? This is one of my favorite whatever you want to call it, television, movie, whatever. This is one of my favorite like visual medium experiences I've had this year. I'm super excited about this movie, and I want more of it, but I don't want to be greedy. I'm just happy that this one exists and it's so well done.
Yeah, it's got such a like incredible like just resource of footage that you mentioned, to the point where somebody I was talking to, a friend of mine, thought it was fake, because it was just like they had like it was too convenient that they had so much footage that I assumed it was fake. And I was like, no, but there's like real newscasters like from the period that are actual people that are talking about the events that are unfolding in the footage that you're watching. So it's like, how could you have faked that unless it's like hyper developed Forrest Gump technology, where it's like, oh, there's Dan Rather from 1982 talking about the Rajneeshis. And it's like, it was pretty, I mean, we will get there in terms of like doctored footage forever altering a reality that eludes us at all turns, and just be like, forget it, I don't want to know anything anymore. But like, yeah, like the sheer like wealth of footage is like, it allows like for a sense of immersion and a sense of like an almost thriller like quality to happen. Like as things kind of take dark turns, and as they invade this like small town, and the small town starts to like go to war with these like at one point idealistic, you know, you could argue occasionally fanatical seeming people, but ultimately like, It's the perfect utopian kind of like story, because it's these people who are truly trying to find like they're a microcosm of idealism that sours into like all the things that corrupt, you know. And so it's like they're trying to find the idealized alternative to what's wrong with the world.
Right.
So it's these people who are about self-improvement and about like accessing your truest self. And so they have this guru named the Bhagwan. Yeah. Who like, he eventually becomes this kind of silent smiling figure, which like after watching, you know, 6+ hours of it, it's hard not to walk into a room with my hands clasped in front of my face. Like, cause it's like, that just seems like a cool greeting now, just to like, just to beam like transcendently while your hands are in front of your face. Seems like the cool thing to do. I don't do it, but it seems nice. So it's like people who are all about like self-actualization, self-improvement, they band together and they build this commune. And it's this like functioning society in the middle of this remote Oregon landscape. And then like any like society itself, the society that they're trying to create an alternative for, things start to sour, things start to corrupt, things start to get like dark and you know, kind of like menacing. And so it's just like the movie takes on this almost thriller atmosphere, and like in a way that as you're watching the news footage of the time, it was just like when you were living your life in the 1980s, and I wasn't cognizant of this group at the time. I'm sure my parents were because they're from Oregon originally, but like enough time would go on in between. You would move on with your life, and you hear about those weird people who all wear red and live in Oregon and seem to be dancing around a lot. But like, it didn't have the compact, like real life. You could sort of like forget about them for a while, and then they'd come back with a weird salacious headline where you're like, oh Jesus, those people they're into crazy shit again. But like the way it's compacted in story form in this documentary takes on like a sense of propulsion and momentum that's really fucking engaging to like to sit with and watch, you know, like it takes on like a thriller quality.
It really does. And I think the immersion that you're talking about with that footage to actually travel back and see what they were seeing then, and, you know, at least from the camera person's perspective, is like, it's like a gift to have for a documentary. And I feel like this is only something that we're going to get more of as well in the future, because all of us are fucking documenting stuff, right? So it's just cool to go back to a story like this and then to be able to tell it with decades of hindsight, retrospect, research, evolution, and growing, you know, maturation in the people involved. And then to have like all this footage for posterity that they were so, that's something I do want to talk about in this documentary that's so awesome, is the pendulum swing of my sympathy and empathy. Well, it's a very empathetic documentary. It's very open and wants to understand everybody's perspective. I love it for that. But my sympathies kept swinging back and forth because for me, I was probably too young and also living in Minnesota. Like this at the time, like I didn't know this was going on. This was new to me when this documentary came out. I didn't know anything about the Rahanishis, and come to find out, you know, yeah, in Eastern Oregon, they just completely revitalized this land when they moved there. It's a very complex story, but essentially Bhagwan and his followers were getting so large in India, he needed to move somewhere and he was acquiring a lot of wealth and blah, blah, blah. So they bought this huge chunk of land that just was like, Eastern Oregon is, you know, is almost desert, most of it. So a lot of the land is kind of arid and dead. And they were right next to this sleepy town called Antelope, Oregon, where maybe like 20 people were just retiring and just living out the last of their days. And in comes this influx of 10,000 plus people, right? And they're strange to these locals. And it just brings up all these, there's just so many pendulum swings of sympathies. The first couple episodes, I'm like, hey, these Rahanishis aren't so bad. They're a little weird, I guess. But like, hey, they actually made that land fertile and like, animals came back and I'm all in their corner. And then like episode 3 ends, I think, on a shot of they started to acquire machine guns and I'm like, I remember saying one of those early episodes, I'm like, I am so in the side of the Rahanishis at this point, and the locals just seem like bigoted, short-sighted assholes that don't like other people coming into their town. And of course, what this movie proves is it's always more complicated than that, and it's not that simple. But I remember saying, like, when is the shoe going to drop here? Like, what was the thing that led to this? Because I know that this is a dark story in terms of where it spins out. And that shot, the great example of, like, I can't believe
it. Yeah, I wouldn't, like, it's actually, like, such a great moment that, like, maybe don't spoil it for whoever hasn't seen it.
Good point. Thank you. Good point. There's just this incredible, another example of like, I'm so glad they had this footage because they're allowed to let an image create an ellipses to keep you binging, right? At the end of that episode, you're like, fuck, what? And they didn't need a talking head to say, you get it, image, boom, there. I mean, it's film, that's cinema, even though this is streaming on Netflix. And I just loved that sort of stuff. So yeah, the pendulum swings of my emotions and sympathies and the whirlwind of just people. Like you're right. I think in the end, this is an example of like, I love people, but I also hate people, like in mass, like me personally, because we fuck everything up. And this is an example of it.
Yeah, that buttoning moment is so, like, I had gasped when it, like, yes. There's an image and it's right before it just cuts to black for like the credits of that episode roll. And like, I'm sure there is a way for you to like edit out the credits and have this be just one seamless experience, albeit an exhausting one. But like, it's worthwhile and it's worth getting lost in, because it does cover like such a spectrum and such, like, it does give voice to like people and nuance to a like discussion and conversation that like largely feels like it's being squeezed out everywhere. And like, it's hard not to look at, you know, the sort of burden of like contemporary life through these like reflections, you know, like in a documentary like this, where you're like, how can you not see a contemporary America in this way, where it's like people pitted against each other, mm-hmm. like in this weird, like clashing ideologies in such a drastic fashion, you know. But it's just like the way they allowed everybody to speak for themselves and for you to be, and to give you room to be like, oh, this person's fucked up. This person's still fucked up. Like, and they're controlling their own narrative. They're not in control of the entire narrative of the piece, but they allow them to speak for themselves in a similar way to like people in O.J. Simpson Made in America. Like Mark Furman was one of the lead detectives. That guy is a fucked up person, but he was humanized, not heroized, but he was humanized and allowed to speak to his own flaws and how fucked up he was in that documentary. Mm-hmm. You ultimately don't walk away being like, he's a good dude. No, not at all. But you're just like, well, he's a lot more complicated than like he was being painted. Like, he still is an incredibly conflicted, corrupt, fucked up person. But it's like, I have a better picture of who he is now because he was allowed to like speak for himself. And like, this movie is full of those people sometimes contradicting themselves, sometimes like getting to a place where they truly find a redemption that's like really overwhelming in the concluding sections of this series, you know. Like, it's mm-hmm. it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, man. And I think more of just the people I'm going to miss, or I have missed since finishing this miniseries of,
you
like,
could always watch it again.
This is true. It's endlessly available, right? My favorite, probably, character, I guess, these are characters in the documentary, is, I can't think of his name, but he talks a lot. He was the lawyer for the Rahanishis, and then became even more. Yeah, you know the guy I'm referring to?
Yeah.
He became almost a more higher political figure within the Rahanish Perm, within their community. I loved that guy. I thought he, even though he was 100%, and he doesn't say anything otherwise, he is full on a believer. He is a true believer of this movement, whatever you want to call it, religion, cult. He is so into it. But I found him incredibly even-handed and sort of balanced as a personality, as a person. And certainly he's on the side of his people, and he, as a lawyer, he did everything he could to defend and back them up and fight for them. But I thought he was really fair and even-handed in his recollections, and I just liked him as a speaker, you know, like, and he's probably my favorite, but he's got nothing, absolutely nothing on, of course, the sort of star of it all is, I would say, Sheila, Anand Sheila. And this woman is both incredible. I was like in awe of her in the beginning and just like in her corner. And then when things really started to curdle and take on a darker edge, a lot of it sort of sources back to her in a lot of ways. And I, even after I got sort of angry with her by the end of the miniseries, I was always understanding of her the same way you're referring to with like the Mark Furman character. In the OJ doc, is like, she does and was responsible for stuff. There are factual evidence of it. She spent time in jail for some of the things she did. She did provable awful things. Yet in this documentary, in my memory, she doesn't admit to anything. Yet tells her story in a way that doesn't feel like she's eliding the truth. She just doesn't admit to anything. And I found her to be such a fascinating person, and also the media, the way she engaged and fought with the local and national media, and then the local politicians and people. Like, oh my God, she's so fascinating and just endlessly watchable, but she is fucked up, man. Like, it's fascinating. She's a fucked up person in my mind, but I kind of loved watching her. So this movie's full of that stuff.
It's also, you know, in terms of like reflecting current reality, it's refreshing to see political figures speak coherently. And then to have the Rajneeshis speak themselves in a very with the poise and polish of like public officials speaking. And then they'll just swear, which is kind of like, you know, we feel betrayed by some of our own who fucked us over. And like, that's the lawyer character you're talking about who went on to become, like, you know, the mayor basically. He says that at one point, and like Sheila calls someone a bitch in the middle of like a town meeting. And it's like, this is a very interesting, like, juxtaposition of like, you know, posturing yourself. And like
the part when Bhagwan removes his silence and he refers to Sheila as a bitch, and that like he never had sex with her, which is what caused all this like animosity between them. I mean, this is stuff that comes later on, but like, I just felt like, oh, like this movie worked so well to like put me in that position that when that came, there's like this awkward TV show where Bhagwan is talking about Sheila. And it's just like, dude, aren't you better than this? But then it's like, maybe you're not, you know, maybe you're not. Yeah. And you are just a dude with a ton of money and you're really good at inspiring people. And that's positive. That could be good. But also you're a fucking dude. And, you know, there's a lot more to his story that the movie sort of gets to. And I almost wanted more of like this, like drug abuse that he was going through. All these things are just there's just so much to chew on in this documentary. But like, yeah, the like vulgarity. I mean, Sheila's the best at that. And the way she, you could tell she loved the spotlight, loved the camera, and she has that smile. It's like a shit-eaten grin, and it's like telling people, I know something you don't, even if she doesn't. And I think that's what pissed so many people off about her, but she's so fascinating as just that figure, man. She's so compelling.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I had talked to somebody yesterday that was talking about how like I wish they went more in depth on. I was like, how much more in depth could they go? This is like a 6-hour thing, and I was just like, you just didn't want it to end. Like, yeah, I guess so. I guess that's accurate.
That's what I came to peace with, because I was saying that throughout the movie. I'd be like, hold on, there seems like there'd be more to what they're referring to, but in the end, the movie gives you plenty. There's so much, and I'm sure there is lots more. I mean, I heard there are stories that after this this compound in Oregon was sort of closed and they left, that like other awful, there's more to this story, absolutely. But in the end, I think it's a compliment to this movie of like, we wanted more of it, and like, I came around to that as well. I think you're right. It's just like, yeah, I just liked it so much, I wanted more. And what a compliment to give to something that's like 400 minutes long, or however many hours, 6+ hours, you know? I just want to go back to like, I love that I want more of these kind of things. This is like my favorite kind of documentary, just this all encompassing retrospect, you know, looking back with the information we have now. That's so fascinating. So I'm glad you liked it too, man.
Yeah. It was nice to see Portland in the 1980s too.
It was, because it certainly doesn't look like the Portland I live in right now, as you know. So
they're showing the documentary, the sort of early 80s documentary of the Rajneeshis, like that comes out and the townspeople go to a theater to see it. You remember the section I'm talking about?
I do. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It looked like the Fifth Avenue Cinemas at PSU.
I heard it was. No, I think it is, or it was in that footage, because one of my coworkers used to work there not that long ago and mentioned that, actually. So I think you're right.
Yeah. Cool.
And that is cool. It is. Very comforting. Very comforting.
Well, speaking of comforting, if you want to pivot to our concluding documentary series.
I think, is there anything else, Judd? Seriously? I'm writing jokes with my friend Judd.
You know, for 25 years, he was the most important mentor that I had. But in a lot of ways, he was a mystery to me.
None of these journals are the same. And it reflects from the time I was 25 till now.
We go back to her place. I'm on the couch, and I'm really getting into it. And she comes into the room.
Gary told an audience, "Don't worry, folks. You're going to feel good by comparison when I leave the stage."
My mother wants to marry me. I told my shrink that, and he did something I've only seen blackjack dealers do. He looked at me, and he went...
Judd Apatow's latest directorial effort was a two-part HBO docuseries called The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling, and went in great depth and detail about the life of Gary Shandling, the legacy of his career. And it's one that, like, I loved the Larry Sanders Show, which Gary Shandling was responsible for, to a depth and degree that I don't know that I understand. Like, I love that show so thoroughly to the bone that I'm just like, I don't know what it is about the show, but we can maybe get into it. But so you watched this documentary before I did. Like, what was your initial experience with Gary Shandling before he was like a documentary subject?
Sure. Actually, I'm glad you asked. You were my inspiration, Joe. You were the wind beneath my wings. When we started working together, I was managing a lot, and like, you would be working with me, like doing the box office at the Film Center. And we had a lot of time to like get to know each other and talk. And we were creating this podcast, so we were like, we had lots to discuss and found common, you know, areas of interest for obvious reasons. And I was kind of in a bummer state at this time, where I only still was new to Portland, and the only job I had was this part-time theater job. And I was just sort of, you know, struggling to get my footing so I could be like, I like it here, but my future, like, how do I know I can make it work, you know? And just going through a lot in that way. And I remember you saying, like, Netflix has all the Larry Sanders right now. I don't know why it's not on HBO, but it's on Netflix right now. And you had, out of the blue, just sort of recommended, like, that's a great thing to dive into, man. I bet you'll like it. And I remember, talk about binging hard. I mean, this was the time where I just wasn't working that much, so it almost can become harmful to watch this much TV. But sure. I dove in, and I went through it, like, in less than a month. It's like 5 or 6 seasons, too. And I just went through it all. And I, needless to say, I fell in love with it very quickly. And I think we can both articulate that to some degree, but I'm in a similar boat. It's just a really, for one, I mean, on a basic level, that show, way ahead of its time. I remember that's how you sort of got me excited to check it out. You're like, that is like the source of all, like, what's hip now in TV and has been for a while. The like single camera, almost documentary like thing, but not a documentary, like Arrested Development did that, or The Office. You had referenced it in that way, and I so agree. This show, way ahead of its time, but also just like the characters, the people you spend time with, like a lot of them are awful, but they're fucking great, and I loved them all. Kind of in that similar way, when you get to know people at work that like you like things about them and you don't, or whatever, but like you want to be around these people, and that show just is kind of like almost perfect in what it was, I think. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of it for me, in all honesty, with Gary Shandling, other than knowing him as a personality, seeing some stand-up or, you know, footage from Johnny Carson and whatnot. That's kind of it for me. And this documentary was really great because I'm already a fan, but it did, for me, expanded on, and really, for me, it was like the perfect, like, memorial, looking back, like, condensed thing about this guy's life and art. And I think it's I think this documentary, which is on HBO, is, I think, possibly Judd Apatow's best thing that he's made. And I like a lot of his stuff. I think this was the thing he was born to make, because you learn, like, Gary Shandling was his mentor and his hero in many ways. So that's kind of my journey with Gary Shandling at this point. But so I thank you. But then I'm just like so thrilled by this beautiful 2-part documentary that, like, seriously, Judd Apatow was born to make this movie, I thought. So I'm very happy about it.
Yeah, it's it gives like a context to, like, because I knew similarly, like, I knew him as like a personality, but really, he really came into, like, I got to know him as the character of Larry Sanders, which, like, watching this documentary, you see the journey to him creating that character, because he was, like, always trying to authentically find himself and be himself and, like, let that let that transformation be the sort of gift of his comedy. And then, like, I didn't really have a context in terms of, like, watching the It's Gary Shandling show. Never really watched that when I was younger. But I watched the Larry Sanders Show on HBO when I was growing up, and, like, would stay up late, watch it, and just, like, wasn't, like, just would get lost in it and love it. And it never changed, because I don't think that that show has really been surpassed, even though there are things that seem similar to it now. And it seemed to, like, spur, like, generations later, like, a type of comedy still is at the apex of, and, like, as good as Arrested Development, Parks and Rec, The Office is, like, Larry Sanders is so at home in itself, in its language, in its atmosphere, that it's not, like, it can't be topped. It's, like, remarkable. I say 6 Feet Under is the best TV show of all time, but, like, just beneath that is the Larry Sanders Show, or maybe neck and neck in a tie, if it's they're racing each other, which I don't know why they would be. But the Larry Sanders Show is just, like, the ensemble, the writing, just the sheer naturalistic quality of it, that it genuinely feels like it's always happening, and you, like, and you feel so at home in it that you want it to always be happening. And that's why, like, as it sort of reached its concluding season, like, it's so, because you made it all the way through, right? You watched it to its end.
Multiple times, because I convinced my girlfriend when we started dating to watch it. I just did it all again.
That's great.
Yeah.
So just, like, having this similar to what you were talking about with, like, supplemental documentaries, like, that's what's, like, remarkable about this, to see, like, to see the story behind how this show was created, and how he, like, he had to create this fiction in order to access a truer part of himself. Because, like, as he was just trying to be himself as a performer, there is that distancing that happens when you're like, I'm me, I'm just me, I'm speaking about what's going on. And so he had to create, like, a fiction in order to access the actual emotional truth, which I think that's what makes that show sing so much, is, like, the vulnerability of these characters. And they're fucking beautiful in that way. Like, I remember watching it with a girlfriend who, like, Jeffrey Tambor's character, however flawed he is as an actual person, he plays, sure, Hank Kingsley. And, you know,
TV characters ever. Let's be honest.
Yeah. Like, he is so, like, in this documentary, Jeffrey Tambor talks about how he was braced by Gary Shandling to be like, you can't prepare for this. And so, like, that's the beauty of, like, his performance as Hank Kingsley, is that he's always, like, flustered. And so, like, I think that's what he meant by you can't prepare for this. You're this raw nerve at all times. And he's bumbling, and he's arrogant, and he's a fuck up. And his, like, humanity is so, like, it's this like, live wire moment of, like, you want to cry for this person, and you're laughing hysterically at and with him, you know? Like, it's, and what that show is, that's what the show is at its best. And it, like, very rarely faltered from that. And I think, like, the documentary gives that context to, like, what Gary Shandling brought to the world. And beyond that, like, you know, you were talking about how he's a mentor to Judd Apatow, and, like, Judd Apatow carries that in terms of his mentorship, and, like, this community he's created out of, like, you know, just a genuine sense of support, where he's, like, he's putting people on to do great things, you know? And, like, that's the sort of, like, legacy that, like, the documentary speaks to. And I think that, like, it was pretty heartening and tear jerky by the conclusion of the Zen Diaries, you know?
The things that I, like, learned from this documentary too, about even just specifically the Larry Sanders Show, was, like, for me, because I came to it so much later than when it was actually on air, that I found fascinating, like, the degree of meta levels, like, you're speaking to this, that, like, so much of what Gary Shandling got wrapped up on with his comedy, and I think why he was an innovator, as this documentary shows so clearly, and someone that just pushed the boundaries and was really an artist, you know, truly, but he always had this meta, hyper-reflexive style that was commenting on things in his own life. And I come to find out that like one of the characters early on in the movie or the show was his actual wife at the time. And the documentary, the documentary like gets in, interviews her, and like obviously Judd has a relationship with her. So like there's this intimacy that really works in this story, this documentary's favor, that might have sunk a lot of other documentaries that are there to memorialize and remember and say what's great about someone that's moved on. But like this one is very even handed as well, and also gives voice to her, because she got kind of fucked over by Gary Shandling in life. And then in this weird meta show universe had to still participate in it. And he used that as fodder, as content, you know, as a way to explore his creativity. And then it goes down the rabbit hole of like when he did like DVD special features, he made her come do an interview about it. And it's like the degree of like, oh my God, it's like, this is too personal. I shouldn't know this information about these people, but it's so fascinating. And that's what really makes this more, because I think we would have liked this if it was just a total loving tribute, but Judd Apatow, I think, really was fair and balanced, and also makes use of a lot of available great archival footage. You know, that's another exciting thing about this movie as well, is that it has that, but has a ton of great talking head interviews with people. Basically everybody in the comedy world, maybe except for Ricky Gervais, we find out, like loves this guy, like for good reason. And you're reminded of like I came to learn what a mentor, and like he was there for a lot of people. And like the story about Conan O'Brien in this documentary, like when he got fired from his show, fuck man, that's so touching. And that's the kind of stuff that Gary Shandling like did for people in his community. So it does lionize him, but it's also like shows his plenty of flaws as a human, and his friends know he was flawed and acknowledge that. There's stuff with Bob Saget that crushed me in this documentary as well, that had to do with their relationship. And this is a guy that I know from his Dirty Comedy and then Full House. And now I'm getting all these dimensions of him as a person. And comedians can be like the most fascinating, touching, sometimes sad people on this planet. And I love that this documentary celebrates that and shows so much of that. Like it just works.
Yeah. Cause it's like their art form is essentially a coping mechanism for what is like a hypersensitivity to the world around them, which is like, you know, that was Gary Shandling, which like he was hypersensitive to the point of being a flawed person in a lot of ways, and hypersensitive to the point where he could really take in like a lot of humanity's struggles and then make them seem manageable through his work and his art, you know. And like, yeah, I kind of want to restart the Larry Sanders Show all over again.
I know, it makes me. I want to find what was the previous one he did? It's Gary Shandling Show. What was it called? The
Gary Shandling Show.
Yeah, that seemed really innovative and meta and cool. I'm sure you can find it somewhere. I'm kind of curious to dive into that, but I would rewatch Larry Sanders in a heartbeat. It's such a special show, man. It brought us together, my friend.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
It was one of the things, I guess. But yeah, that was a key moment for me. And I'm also just kind of proud of Judd Apatow in my way, because like I haven't really like loved the movies he's directed lately. I think all of them have things that remind me of what makes him special as a comic director. I think of Funny People, which I think is half of almost a masterwork, and then the other half is not. And there, you know, This Is 40 is like got its moments, you know. Like I'm always still curious to see what Judd Apatow's doing, but I started to think like maybe he's just doing more good as a producer and sort of paying it forward himself by giving people like Amy Schumer or Seth Rogen and all these people he's helped give careers to and give opportunities to. Maybe he's doing better work there. But then to just see this like, oh, here's a documentary that he directed and it's perfect, and I'm just kind of happy to be reminded like Judd Apatow can still make a really great movie, and this is it for me. So I'm super, you know, I'm excited on this episode, Joe. These documentaries got me excited.
Okay, I'm glad.
All right, man, what do you think? I'm about as exhausted as after watching these long ass documentaries. Why don't we wrap it up?
Yeah, we kept it real for as long as we could. So just chill
to the next episode. So let's wrap up episode 174 of Adjust Your Tracking. I had a list of documentaries I was going to point out to people to check out, but it seems sort of arbitrary. So all I'm going to say before we totally wrap up is there's a couple ones coming out in the summer here soon. Starting in May, there's that Ruth Bader Ginsburg documentary, RBG. I'm looking forward to that. Looks very good. And then Won't You Be My Neighbor, the Mr. Rogers documentary, which that trailer, man, crushes me every time. I want to see that movie. It looks like it's going to be really great. And I'm excited because both those docs are going to be coming to my theater in Portland. And they might be really big hits for us in the summer movie season, which is, I think, very cool and rare. So, documentaries, of course, coming down the pike.
Yeah, I thought maybe I had been all cried out by the trailer for Won't You Be My Neighbor? And then I think I mentioned it on a previous episode that when I saw Isle of Dogs in the theater and it was trailered ahead of time, I was just like, oh, no, I'm going to cry in public now. Okay, here goes.
I've been playing that trailer and RBG trailer, which made me choke up too, man, both of them. I've just been playing them in the beginning when a movie starts just to like let the audience get it out of their system so they can get to the movie. But very effective stuff. So, look out for those. I'm sure one or the other we'll probably talk about on the podcast. So look forward to that. So you can find all of Adjust Your Tracking's latest episodes at theplaylist.net. You can also click on the podcast tab and you'll find all the other shows on the Playlist Podcast Network there. So go to theplaylist.net. You can communicate with me and Joe at adjustyourtracking@gmail.com. We prefer email. We are on Facebook, aren't we, Joe? Still? I wouldn't know. I'm not on there very much.
Yeah, so our personal information is being mined for nefarious purposes. So, what are you going to use the fact that we like Lynn Ramsey's movies against us in a political campaign? I doubt it. So
they'll find some way, those Russian bots. And we'll see.
He's chilling up and like cats a whole lot. Let's see if we could sway his vote. What? Oh, okay, good luck.
You liked Ketty, so maybe you'll like Donald Trump or something like that. It's weird. We're in a weird world, Joe.
He seems like an anti-cat person. Fuck that guy.
I bet you're right. It's another reason, and it's always good to say fuck that guy indeed. So with that, if you say fuck that guy, we are already friends with you and we thank you, but I got to thank Joe for talking with me today. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you. It was pretty heartening and tear jerky by the conclusion of the Zen Diaries, you know? Are you still there?
Yes. Sorry. I was being distracted by my girlfriend and I just told her to go away. hold on. I'm going to mark this so I can cut it. Sorry about that, dude.
No, keep it in there. It's all part of it. It's real.
Oh, it's very Larry Sandler's esque. That's Sandler. The thing too. Yeah, I can't talk. It's thrown off my game. Well, that,